This is 307 Net Info, connecting community.
This is Kit Harness with 307 Net Info, and today we're going to be talking about the house draw fire, which actually just 2 weeks ago burned through. It was ignited by a lightning strike in it, and it burned through in just a very few short days, over 175,000 acres of Johnson County, east of Buffalo, which actually now makes it the largest single fire in Wyoming in state history. And I'm joined today by three experts in the environmental aspect of looking back at this fire and what we can learn about from it and what we need to do coming forward from that. So I'm joined by Ryan Fieldgrove. Hello, Ryan. Nice to meet you again.
Hello, Kate.
Would you just like to explain what capacity you're here talking to us in?
Sure. So I am a local supervisor for Clear Creek Conservation District and also sit on the board for Wyoming Association Conservation Districts as their vice president. I believe that I represent our area probably from the perspective of a rancher and the rancher community.
Thank you. And Alison McKinsey, welcome to 307 Net Info. You are with the USDA, but you're also with the National Resource Conservation.
Yes, correct. Kate, yeah, I'm the district conservationist for NRCS, which is Natural Resource Conservation Service.
Thank you. And Zach Byron, welcome. Thank you for spending some time with us. You're the district manager for Clear Creek Conservation District. That's correct.
Yeah, that's correct.
Good. Yes, well, thank you. Kate. And so one of the reasons that I'm grateful that you all came together with me is you know a lot about the environment and the environmental impact that this fire will have had. But I think it's worth pointing out that probably 85% of the fire was actually on private land. So the implications are going to be quite great for those landowners, many of whom are ranchers like yourself, Ryan, and who live off the land. You basically, that is where their livelihood comes from. And this kind of fire, even if it didn't damage your whole property, has a significant impact on how you conduct your business day to day. So there is that to bear in mind. The other thing that I mentioned was just the large scale, the enormous area that 175,000 acres of fire actually equates to. I mean, it's if you look at the map, it's roughly Buffalo to KC. It's over 40 miles in this long, thin stretch, but it touches over 60 properties, I believe. So maybe we could just take a moment to talk about what happens to vegetation and what sort of vegetation it was out there. My understanding is that it was largely sagebrush and grass, not very remarkable landscape, no big trees, nothing really to kind of get in the way of it. But what most people might look at and say is, that's nothing. What is that? And maybe you could explain to us what the value of that kind of terrain is.
Yeah, and you know, people are right when they say it's sagebrush and grass, but it's more than just sagebrush and grass, especially from a perspective of not just the ranchers, but also the wildlife that utilize that kind of landscape. I mean, that's the easy way to break it down is to say it's sagebrush and grasses. Of course, there's cool season grasses, warm season grasses. There's a couple different kinds of sagebrush. Most of it was Wyoming big sagebrush, and probably some silver sagebrush to a lesser extent. And Allison would know more about the communities that are out there than I would. But from the perspective of the fire, I guess I'd like to also say that, you know, we still have more unknowns than we have knowns, even from what our expectations for recovery from the community, from the grass and sagebrush community. But from the standpoint of the fire, as we were talking about a little bit earlier, you know, it burned in some places in a mosaic, which is kind of how you, from a fire ecology perspective, is how you would like to see fires burned. It creates what's known as edge effect, which when you have a greater edge in a community, it provides more habitat. Now, I know it's burned at this point, but when it starts coming back, it provides that edge effect provides additional habitat uses oftentimes will provide different types of grasses in more areas. But there are also, on the flip side of that, are some areas that got burned really hot and heavy where there's not a mosaic. I have not been out or been in the air to see it all, but from talking with some folks and seeing a little bit of my own, there are some large patches or areas that did not get burned. And then there's other areas, obviously, that got burned really badly. But like I said, Allison could probably speak more fluently about the actual communities that were out there.
Yeah, it's just a very healthy landscape that got burned. The majority of it, I would say, was very good native vegetation with the sagebrush in it. And so we lost that. And the sagebrush is going to be hard to come back. The grass will be there. The native grass will be there. And so we'll have the grass production. But the loss of the sagebrush is critical for lots of aspects, from the wildlife to holding the snow and all of that. So it just is going to take time to see what we truly lost and where we go from here. But we all need to just take a breath and know that it'll come back. The natives will come back.
So what is it that's going to stop the sagebrush from coming back?
Well, and Ryan can speak to this probably better than I, because Ryan has tried to seed sagebrush into an old burn. I believe we did try that. And it's just the sagebrush seed has to be way cold temperatures to have it expand to be ready to germinate in the spring. And then it's just... the wildlife like it because it's tender. If it does come up, they love to graze on it. So then that hinders it. And it's just very tough. We have had, Wyoming has a very tough time getting it to come back.
Yeah, from my perspective, it's completely circumstance on what are the environmental conditions. And so, you know, if we were to stop and think, you know, let's go back to 300, 400 years, there's nothing wrong with fire. Fire is one of the most rehabilitative aspects that can happen to any range or forest, right? But you add humans and you add economic stability to that, that's where we become unbalanced, right? Humans need to live off the resources, and to do so means there must be some type of economic benefit. So in 50 years, that range will probably go back to the normal sagebrush steppe with all the native forage. Our biggest issue is truly invasive species, invasive grasses, invasive weeds, because there again, we're using it differently than the natural environment. That being said, to answer the question about sagebrush, sagebrush seems to love no competition. Right? So in the event that you did nothing with this fire, say like no chemical treatment, no grazing, anything, sagebrush is going to have a hard time anyway. That might be 100-year restoration in its natural state. I don't believe, from what I've experienced, that any true man-made mechanical replanting of sagebrush is effective. It's just not cost effective. Zach was alluding to the mosaics and the edge.
Yes, and just to sort of point out, if you'd been following any of the apps that when the fire was actually raging, you would see on them those numbers sometimes, and sometimes they were presented as hotter, brighter zones than others. And that was really demonstrating that the fire doesn't go across at an even temperature, and sometimes it actually skipped areas, like you said, Zach. So it's this, as you use the word mosaic, and I think that's a nice way of describing it, but it is patchy. Mm-hmm. So that, therefore, the impact is patchy too.
It is patchy. The mosaics in those islands have sagebrush or existing other forbs in those, and those will serve as a seed bank. The problem that we will have is we won't be able to see a ton of progress with that for 20 years. Maybe 50 years.
So as a rancher, that kind of terrain, what is it? What's its value to you?
Yeah, that's a hard one. You know, land costs are high. If you were to just go outright and purchase that property, and I would say an average per acre price is going to be anywhere from $500 to $1,200 an acre for just range land, grassland predominantly. And so the value is, what is the productive unit, right? So we're going to, we can measure that if we're going to run livestock on it, because we have carrying capacities. Allison calculates animal unit months and carrying capacities for each type of soil and each type of precipitation zone. So we know on average what its production is, and then we have to convert that to some marketable commodity, such as sheep or cattle production. But then we have the other economic value, which is hunting and recreation. And, you know, that's a large play in Wyoming. That's what Wyoming is significantly about, is the value of hunting and recreation to a lot of our citizens. And the ranching communities have been able to capitalize on that with, you know, leasing or harvesting those animals, et cetera. So that's the hard number. That one's hard to put the number on.
So it's not necessarily just grazing land.
Right.
It has more dimension to that. So I'd like to come back and talk about wildlife in a moment and so on. But we know that as the fire raged, basically people who felt that they were likely to be affected, they essentially just opened their gates or cut their fences and let as much of their livestock out or moved them as safely as they possibly could. But there was a degree of mortality. And obviously there were some creatures who were too small or too confused. Not every animal is sensible and knows to get out of the way of fire or couldn't get out of the way of fire. And so we know that there has been quite a lot of mortality. I think, Zach, you were telling me earlier that we have a pretty good handle on livestock now as to kind of the numbers that were actually killed. And I don't know whether that includes injury, because injury is another factor that we need to consider going forward as we recover too. But there is mortality of a whole ecosystem, essentially, but also displacement from this. So turning and looking at what lives on that land that we've just described, on that sagebrush steppe, what do we think is going to happen from that? There are herds of elk and antelope and mule deer and presumably white-tailed deer as well that are displaced. Where do they go? What happens to them? Can you maybe paint a picture for us of what we should be anticipating?
Yeah, I think outside of the unknown losses in terms of numbers of animals, because surely there is loss of wildlife, but I don't know that we're ever really going to know what that number is. I think we're going to be surprised to see how adaptable wildlife is, to be honest with you. I think especially after some rains that we've had, I think we're going to start to see a little bit of green up. And I think antelope in particular will be back in using the burned areas relatively soon. There's still water out there, you know, whether it's stock tanks or springs or, you know, there's probably some reservoirs as well. So I think this is going to be a real good show of how adaptable Mother Nature really is. And I think we're going to see that in the wildlife. There's certainly this short-term displacement. I know Ryan mentioned to me that a couple of days after the fire, he saw more mule deer along Crazy Woman Creek than he'd ever seen before. And now they're gone again. So they've gone back somewhere. Anecdotally, I've talked to several people that have seen gobs and gobs of sage grouse in the medians and varroa ditches along the interstates, and they have since started to eke back into wherever they came from. I think mule deer are going to be a little bit slower to come back into the burn. I think they're going to be looking for areas where there still are some forbs growing and there's more grass available to them. I think elk, same kind of thing. I think they're going to move into the areas where there's still more feed available. But I think over time, we're going to be surprised to see how adaptable that wildlife is and how they can come back. The biggest issue I see currently is with the sage grouse and the other sagebrush obligates. So sagebrush obligate is, mostly it's birds, but there are some mammals that rely heavily on it as well. But there's a slew of birds, including sage grouse, which is kind of the hot button item, I guess.
Sage grouse, it is a hot topic, isn't it? And I believe that there were about 18 leks that were destroyed in the fire. Now, I don't know how. Maybe somebody can tell me how devastating that is. I mean, 18 out of how many, say? What is likely to be the impact for a protected species already?
Yeah, I think that's also going to be something that is an unknown. I mean, outside of just losing areas that we call leks, which is where the males display in the spring to try to attract mates, the really big issue is the approximately 100,000 acres of what is deemed a core area has been burned. Now, we don't know. We can simply put the fire perimeter shape file on top of the known core area and come up with a number that's right around 108,000 acres. But of that 108,000 acres, how much of that actually burned? You know, going back to the mosaic discussion, we don't know that yet. But because sage grouse rely so heavily on sagebrush and sagebrush doesn't come back very quickly, that's going to be... And from the wildlife perspective, I think that's going to be the biggest issue that we're going to be facing and how that moves forward, because the core area that got burned was the middle third of it. So it got cut right in half. So then you start thinking about genetic variability, that could be gone now. The birds that lost that were able to get out of the way. And again, they're not the smartest bird to start with. So who knows how many of them just hunkered down and got burned over. That's something we won't know either. And they also don't necessarily recover very well quickly from any type of population decline, whether it's, West Nile or some type of anthropogenic disturbance or a hailstorm in the spring that kills a bunch of chicks. But that sage grouse issue is going to be real, and it's going to be big, and it's going to be important for not just the state, but the western states in terms of how U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service looks at its next potential listing. Like, this fire is going to be a trigger point, I think.
Thank you. So another touch is what actually happens to the soil itself. I mean, we know that when you heat something up, you change... Basically, it's chemistry, literally. It's composition. What does fire do in terms of, will it be for this kind of terrain? Is it going to be a more fertile and more conducive environment for those species to come back, or maybe even for invasive species to take better hold? Do we know anything about that? Given, of course, that it's not even an even burn area, so it's going to be patchy again.
I think that's exactly what it's going to be, is that we've gotten the different heats that went through it. The hotter the fire, the less vegetation we're going to have. It's going to take a while for that to come back versus the quick fire that I've seen a lot of. That's going to treat our native plants very well, and they'll come back. So I think it just all depends, and it appeared from what I've seen. I have not seen the middle of or the heart of it, and I think that's probably where our heat is, where the hottest spots were. But the edges that I saw, I was down in KC and came up and looked from the bottom, and then I was out on out here a little bit, and it just, there isn't a lot of hot. So that's a very good thing. I think a lot of it was wind-driven and very fast. At the one meeting, the firefighter told us that it averages 4 miles wide, and the 42 miles long. So it just was so fast that we're kind of thankful for that. So I think our soils aren't going to change a lot.
Yeah, and if you remember the conditions over those two or three nights that it significantly raged and created the area. It was incredibly windy those nights. And it just literally, the fire just seemed to blow its way down.
I think when we looked at the soils, you know, and the sad thing is we're going to go into the winter. For true soil health, you want a living plant in the soil, and we're not going to have that. So that's going to be a little bit of a detriment.
So are we at risk of erosion and degradation?
Mm-hmm. So just like last night coming back from Sheridan with the wind that we had, it looked like we had another fire. The fire had come back, and it was just the ash that was blowing. Mm-hmm. And I spoke to a landowner, and that's what she told me, is that it just... So we're blowing, the ash is leaving us, good or bad. We're losing some.
And actually, topsoil with it as well.
A little, but I think you still got a lot of roots there. So the roots are going to hold it, even though they burnt. They're going to hold.
And those roots survive to create new plant growth. It's not just reseeding.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, all of the native stuff. I don't know if I should say all. The majority of the native plants that are out there, historically, have adapted to fire. And so, like Allison's saying, especially in the areas where it blew over pretty quickly, the roots are still there. It's honestly not a whole lot different than it being grazed by a deer or a cow. It still has its sugars and carbohydrates in its roots that can reestablish the above ground biomass. But as long as the below ground is still there, the above ground will come back for sure.
So, Allison, you mentioned invasive species, and that's a word I've been hearing a lot in the past year or two. Maybe you could just explain to people who are not familiar with what invasive species, what they are, maybe some names that we could attach them, but also what's good or bad about them.
So, sure, Kate. So cheatgrass, I think, is the first thing that we think of as an invasive species. And so it just outcompetes the native vegetation in the spring. If it gets the opportunity, it's the first thing to grow green up in the spring. There is forage value in it in the spring. But then, of course, it matures and goes dormant quickly. So... But it just majorly outcompetes other plants.
So does it actually strangle other plants from...
It doesn't strangle them. It just takes the soil moisture away from them.
Yeah, uses the soil moisture.
So is it nutritious for grazing?
They say it is early. They say that for a little bit they will graze it. I can't tell you exact protein.
Have you had a direct experience with it? Mine?
Yeah, I believe so. I think the community the ranching practice is to use it in the spring. As long as it's green, it's palatable. As long as it's palatable, it's useful. But the minute it does go dormant, like Allison said, it produces that really stickery seed head that gets embedded in, the jaws or under the tongue of livestock and creates a lot of abscess. And so they're smart. They're not going to eat it anymore. And then there it is producing a seed head that goes, unused, if you will.
So we've been having programs that have been trying to spray and prevent cheatgrass. Are there any other invasive species that we need to be concerned about now?
Yeah, I think the one that we're all most scared of, because we've been living with cheatgrass for a long time, not to take away that it is an invasive, and it certainly is problematic, but there's a new one that's been showing up in Johnson County, just in the course of the last 6 months. And quite a bit has been found recently, even a couple new locations today. I don't know if you talked to Alan at all.
But, yep.
And it's called Ventinata. And what makes it worse than cheatgrass is it behaves a lot like cheatgrass in terms of, it prefers coming into a disturbed area. It outcompetes natives by utilizing the soil moisture more efficiently and more quickly. Where a lot of our native grasses, their taproot goes down to access water. These invasive grasses, their roots go out in order to get more in a shallower area. The problem with Ventinata is that it has little to no palatability, or like Ryan said, because there's no palatability, there's no usefulness to it. Cattle won't even eat it when it's, as far as we know, livestock won't eat it even when it's young and green because it has a high silica content. So it's like chewing
dry.
Very dry and almost so like sandy, like you would be, you know, you dropped your sandwich at the beach and you picked it up and took a bite of it, and you're not going to eat that because all the little sand particles in it. It's kind of what ventanada is. It's not palatable at all. So, and it, it, as I said, behaves much like cheatgrass. And I think there's even the opportunity for it to outcompete cheatgrass as well, which is a real problem.
So I have to ask, we're talking about invasive. It's invaded from where? Is it, have we got it here? And how does it travel? Do we need to be concerned about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think originally all of these invasive grasses we can blame on Eurasia at some point, but more recently, ventanada has been moving down kind of from Oregon into like through Idaho into Montana, and that's where we've been getting it from. Is it came from Montana in, I believe, the Pryor Mountains into Sheridan County, and then Sheridan County.
How is it spread?
Oh, there's a million different vectors for it. Can be transferred on wind. It can be transferred by a dog, a hunter, a bicyclist, you know, recreationist, livestock. Somebody moving cows from one area to another, a four-wheeler. It can get on a deer or an antelope, and it only takes a handful of seeds. And so the number of vectors that can move the seed is... I don't know that you can put a number on that. And so it's not like you can just say, okay, no more four-wheeler use in this area and stop if that's not. It's not that simple.
So what can we do about invasive species? Now we accept that they're here and probably going to keep coming at us. What can we do? Can we spray?
We can, and we're working on that, trying to figure out the best way to spray it. Right there now, there's two chemicals that we can spray to help control it. It isn't a one-time fix either. The sad thing about it is it seems like that we can set it back, but we can't totally get rid of it with spraying it the first year. It seems like we have to spray it 1 year and then come back the third year. So I guess, go ahead, Kate.
Would you be needing to spray all 175,000?
No.
Is that even viable? How would you pick and do that? And is it a very expensive?
So at the moment, we don't have ventanada that we know of yet in the burn. But we easily could. You know, and so we're just going to have to really survey the areas and know, because it doesn't have a certain area. It likes all soil types. It likes shallow, deep. I mean, all of the areas that are out there in the fire it could live in. So I think it's just something that we have to be making everybody aware of what it looks like and be able to control the small patches before they get large.
So Ryan, as a rancher, you probably have an opinion or a perspective on this, but also with your conservation hat on as well, what's your opinion about the right thing to do now?
Yeah, I think that, you know, first of all, I think we all are anxious and eager to try to help those impacted. So we want to deploy some type of management tactic or service or resource towards them for their benefit. I believe that, you know, I think it's necessary to look at what fire does. It can be a positive. There are several positive aspects of fire on the landscape, right? I think it's an opportunity. So if you want to just, you know, I think we're all self-aware of, you know, the hardship that it's created. But I think we can be positive, and we can look at, with the right type of USDA funding, right, the right type of management, and the right timing, and then the right amount of help from Mother Nature, there can be a lot of positive. So I think we just need to put those steps in line that make sense and start working towards the end goal of getting all of those operations back to a state of sustainability, which is just ongoing production, right? With that, I think most of us believe that there are several aspects of rangeland management and ranching that go hand in hand that are equally and mutually beneficial to each other. I think a big one, and these two professionals actually work in this every single day, is that rangeland ecology management. So it might be spraying in certain areas that are of high risk for both cheatgrass and bentonata. We definitely know that there's fencing that needs to be done for rangeland grazing management. It's also the same time that we can look at the type of fence that's more wildlife friendly, that allows for better migration, because that is a sociological hot topic right now. And then I would say the biggest concern for me environmentally is, what is the sage-grouse story going to be like, right? Because we've just spent, it feels like 20 years trying to protect them, and Mother Nature undid it in a couple days.
To somebody who might be listening who is not familiar with the sage-grouse backstory, maybe you could just explain the context of why sage-grouse is so important and why we've put so much focus on them in the last 20 years.
Go ahead.
Yeah, we all wonder that. So, you know, it's they were a threatened species, and threatened means almost endangered. With endangered species, there's lots of restrictions. I think Wyomingites are scared of regulation and restrictions, Kate. We don't want Big Brother telling us what to do. That's the biggest thing. But I will say this. I think every Wyomingite, every rancher appreciates wildlife and understands its value. And I don't even believe that it's economic value. I think that we all grew up as little kids appreciating, you know, the gifts of God's creation, if you will. With that, you know, my, I guess, sentimental attachment to sage grouses, I remember them as a very young child with my dad feeding cattle and wondering, what were all these big fluffy birds making this funny sound? And then, you know, you have a period of your youth where you forget about that. And then all of a sudden you think back and you're like, where'd they all go? There's still some there, but they're not 100 anymore. Well, you know, their environment has changed, and therefore the, you know, the decline in the population, and that warrants the threatened status and potentially the endangered or listed status, and therefore all the government protocol that we've experienced within the state and nationally. So it's an endangered species, and we as humans like to protect those or preserve those. And there is good reason. There's economic balance. Sage grouse, I think, are really a puppet for what is the value of sagebrush ecology in our environment, in the greater West, in Wyoming, in Utah, and Nevada, and Idaho, and Montana, South Dakota, et cetera. What value is sagebrush? It provides so much variation and diversity in all the species, you know, prairie birds and habitat for mule deer and elk and everything. So I think that we focus on the sage grouse, but it's really all these other species. They are just the most impacted. So we study those because we believe that they tell us what is the health.
And indeed, everything is a chain. We're all connected. Every single element in an environment actually has a role or a part to play somehow or other. So you eliminate or you weaken one part of the chain and the whole chain is compromised.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So water. We all need water to survive. I don't know whether the fire retardant chemicals and so on that were used in various parts of the fire, and obviously there was water that was scooped literally just straight out of Lake Smet and dumped back down, that's not going to have been damaging. But do we think there is damage from the various water sources to the water sources that were there already, and also from the water sources or other retardant elements that were actually used to extinguish the fire in various places. Do we think that that's going to have an impact?
My concern with water quality or water impacts is going to be from potential erosion and runoff for the areas that did get particularly, they didn't burn particularly hot, you know, where there's no grass or sagebrush to hold that water back from running into draws or down into ephemeral streams or in the stock water ponds or reservoirs. That could be a potential problem too if you have a bunch of ash-laden water running into a stock pond or down in ephemeral drainage. The fire retardant, though, I'm not really all that concerned about any impacts from that necessarily, especially not any long-term. You know, I know that they're supposed to, like on a forest fire, they're supposed to try to stay, you know, I don't know the exact distance, so, but I want to say, we'll say 200 feet from a water body with the fire retardant. Out here where we don't have as many light streams, you know, it is the Powder River, there's some springs here. Yeah,
especially this time of year, it is. Mm-hmm.
So I'm not really all that concerned about the fire retardant. I'm just more concerned about potential for water quality issues, you know, with runoff.
And so erosion is bad because it takes away the soil that could potentially grow new vegetation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
And the water, there isn't a lot of water out there like we were talking about. And then what I did see, the little bit that I got out and looked at it, is those areas where the water, where the reservoirs were or that had the green vegetation around it. And so they didn't burn as well as the, and so it kind of just glazed past then. So I don't know. You know, I haven't seen Dry Creek. Dry Creek was majorly hit. So that would be a concern, I guess, on water quality there. But I think for the most part, the runoff won't be a huge issue. The other blessing is we had really good plant communities on a lot of it, that we still have the root base. You can go and see that. I mean, the real hot areas are completely black, but the majority of it, you can see the plant base holding everything together. So I think that's a positive for us.
We need to order some light fall rain, Kate. Get a little regrowth before winter. Long that earthless soil back.
I did want to ask you about that, because it's a seasonal moment here. I mean, we coming out of a hot, dry summer. It took a while to get hot this summer. And of course, last year we had a lot of rain well into the summer season, and that created a lot of growth. I assume that some of that growth was still there, and that's what mm-hmm. made such good ignition mm-hmm. Material for the fire. And then, of course, the weather conditions itself. But we're in early September now. It's pretty clear that winter is coming. There are things that need to be done. And on the whole, those are the things that man needs to do to recover, and those are going to be spraying, presumably, but also fencing is a major challenge, and just getting enough fence in before winter and the ground becomes too hard to do that. But the seasonality of this, is there any benefits or pros or cons to the fact that it happened in late August? We're still not necessarily out of fire season. There could potentially be another one, heaven forbid. What do we need to do before the snow flies?
I would say the priority is fencing for the ranchers and the landowners, because that, as Ryan said earlier, you know, fences can lead to helping with grazing management, which is going to be beneficial in the long term from the environmental aspect. And since that's what we're kind of talking about too, we've talked about the invasive grasses and we've talked about spraying, and that's certainly something that needs to be done. But I think in speaking, you know, we have some other groups that Allison and I are parts of, and we've been meeting a little bit. We have some more meetings to go, of course, but I think what the plan is just take a deep breath, take a step back, let's assess what's out there. Then we come up with a better game plan, because we don't want to rush into something just because we feel like that's what we need to do. And with Allison and I, you know, our jobs and in landscape management and rangeland management and anything environmental, I know humans want things, they want to see change, they want to see it happen like that. They want to go out there, they want to spray, they want to reseed, they want to do all these things. But the restoration process and the scale of fire like this isn't going to happen in months or in single years. It's going to be measured in decades. So what we're wanting to do is think long term and come up with a game plan and approach that's going to be beneficial for, of course, short term, you want to see that, but what's the best thing for resource managers to do for that burn in the long term or for the long term? One thing that comes to my mind is, you know, we're talking about spraying in the black and spraying invasives and all of that. My hope is that we don't forget about the important habitat that wasn't burned when we're talking about sage grouse and mule deer habitat in particular. You know, there's still areas that are intact that are also under attack from invasive annual grasses. So maybe that's something we focus on and give the fire a little bit of time, see what Mother Nature does. In the meantime, we have to come up with a lot of money, Kate. if we're gonna effectively treat the burn, which is why we want to see, get a better handle on what actually is out there and then prioritize, because with the dollar signs that we're talking, it's going to have to be prioritized, and it's probably going to be a phased approach, I would assume, in some way, shape, or form.
Is it possible for the area to recover, or is it forever going to be changed?
It's forever going to be changed. It'll recover. You know, the native grasses will come back. Sagebrush will eventually come back in spots, maybe in 20, 25 years, but it's never going to be like it was. You know, it might be sagebrush comes back in 100 or 200 years and maybe looks like it used to, but
the grass production is going to be there. The grass, the native production, and the, if we were truly looking at it from the rancher standpoint, we're going to have a lot more grass to be able to run a lot more livestock, possibly. The downfall is, yes, that we're not going to have the sagebrush to help us hold our snow so that we have more additional moisture in the spring so that we can have more production of grass. So that's a problem. But yeah, I think it's still really positive. It changed, but we're not out of the business. The ranchers aren't out of the business by any means. I don't feel like they're going to have the production and possibly better production. They just have to take a breath as well. And I think we all as resource professionals know the plan they should take, but they have to take a breath and say, okay, there's a lot of balls that they're trying to keep up in the air, you know, or they know they have to build a fence. They have to see if their water system still works. You know, I've talked to landowners that their well casing has melted. So, you know, what does that cause? Can we get the pump out of there? Is the pump okay? There's a lot of things that they have to check, as well as take care of the livestock and figure out the plan for the winter. You know, if they had enough land that didn't burn, can they stay? Do they need to truly look for other land to lease? And so, yeah, I think it's just a huge scope of trying to understand all of it.
And I make the letter of that. I hope to have another conversation, a dedicated conversation to the impact on the ranching community and also the hunting and outfitting community too.
Mm-hmm.
Ryan, do you have anything that you'd like to add?
You know, I think that I would just say that we know that there's impact. We know that there's value in fire. I think that you sum it up, or at least from the ranching and economic perspective, is it's the equivalent of, say, a village or a town and the whole main street burns, every bit of it. And those businesses let's say they were able to get most of their retail product out, and the people and the residents are still there, but they need to move. They need to move for a year for them to reconstruct and rebuild. That is never an easy feat. And that's what the ranching community is experiencing. They're going to be displaced. They're going to be displaced at least until probably the 1st of June next year. And they've got to bear the burden of that expense. And then, you know, they're in 175,000 acres. There's a lot of production loss that needs to be purchased, or, you know, somehow they're going to release. So I think that that's the biggest hurdle right now is, you know, watching that happen. And hopefully those people are able to navigate that time.
So the challenges are really logistics of working with the seasonality of the industry itself, and then just the sheer brutal cost of however much it is. I mean, I've heard various numbers about the estimates for the amount of fence, but it could be 2,000 miles of fence that we've lost as it sort of zigzagged and crossed over the various pieces of terrain. That's a lot of very expensive capital to put back in place. And the opportunity is to put it in, I guess, as you were alluding to, in a way that actually is better for that land. But that also needs to be thought about, and it needs to be paid for. And we're on the clock. Because the season keeps marching on. And the cattle need to move on to their next cycle. So there's a lot of challenges, a lot of logistical headaches and anxiety for ranchers, I assume.
And just like prime example, you know, you mentioned that it was 2 weeks ago and the interstate still isn't fenced, you know, and they had the manpower and the equipment, you know, so it does take time to make it all work.
Yes, and I think that again speaks to the consequence of such a huge area that was impacted, and the scale of it is really what adds the difficulty, that the logistical and the expense difficulty. I mean, there have been figures that just to Johnson County alone, it's going to cost somewhere between $5 and $6 million just in the firefighting initiatives that Johnson County was involved in. That's before we even got to a federal level team and so on. So there are huge, huge sums of money.
Well, it's on average about $15,000 for 1 mile of fence. And so we don't really know what the estimate is. I've heard it all over the place, but yeah, that is a lot of expense for a lot of fence that needs to be rebuilt. And I believe we think that on average it's about $74 an acre to chemically spray the cheatgrass, of which we hope would also be then not a sprain if necessary. So that's...
And if we think outside our boundaries, if we don't think about our little county and state boundaries, in our region, we have 5 large significant fires. We have the Remington fire, which is even larger than the Housedraw fire. It actually spreads much further north, but to the east, we have the Flat Rock and the Constitution fire, and now the Silver Spoon fire, which is still raging. So there's a lot of recovery effort, a burden of recovery effort on our area. It may not fit into our geographical boundaries or the way that we like to think of ourselves, but the burden is going to be felt widely across the region.
Yeah, we wonder, you know, the landowners are wondering if they can even find the supplies to build on the fence, you know, and on top of finding the labor to get the fence in.
Well, and that's typically been one of the issues, you know, on the East Coast, for example, where there have been significant storms that have caused a great deal of damage, is actually...
Contractors.
Yes, contractors, finding the people who can come and do it, and then being able to get the materials that are needed. And of course, the price goes up because the demand is there. So we're somewhat at our own mercy. But thank you very much indeed for explaining to us really about what this fire has meant for the environment and for the land, and what could potentially come next. I very much appreciate your time and your insight.
Thank you.
Thank you, King.
Yeah, thank you.
This is 307 Net Info, unedited and unfiltered.